Hey everybody, my name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Mark.
And we had a nice, Sandy knows this is coming. We had a great ride up here. Billy gave me great directions. And then Sandy said, that's my wife, Sandy, she's an Al-Anon. She said, I know a shortcut. Well, the directions that we got off of Google Map or the other one, MapQuest, said it would take exactly 1 hour and 37 minutes, but she was absolutely right. Her directions were better that we got here in exactly 1 hour and 43 minutes. So I think she did that to get even with me. You know, we alcoholics, I don't know if y'all do this, but we are busy folk. And I like to try and do too many things at once. And I don't know if there's anybody here ever does that. Like, yeah, like 3 hours and you schedule 4 hours of work and then they wonder why you're hectically running from one thing to another. So I figured, like you doing the checkbook like that. Yeah, I see you do checkbook. Well, I figured, well, I've got a master's of education program at my work, which I'll talk a little bit about how that happened to me, that I actually got to be in one, because I wasn't supposed to be in one, obviously, as an alcoholic. But I thought I'd read the homework, which is, of course, due tomorrow, in the car on the way up here. And let me tell you what, when you take the shortcut from Richmond to here, and you're reading, it can make you really sick in the car. that was a wild ride. I've never perspired. I'm like, oh, my God, this car is incredibly hot. By the time I got here, I needed a scopolamine patch and some Phenergan. But it was a lot of fun. It was a good drive. And I'm driving myself on the way back. I'll make her read just to get even. That's my plan. Trying to light read out loud. My sobriety date is December 27th, 1994. And I'm a member of the Into Action Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a group that we've been in existence about 2.5 years. And we started ourselves. A group of us got together, about three of us, and we said, Let's get into action. And we decided, what would we want in a group? And we made exactly the group that we wanted. We decided we would do CPC, PI, treatment and corrections in the group, and actually have projects in the group. And we embarked on a journey. And we haven't looked back since. It's been a real joy. When I got one thing about what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I guess I was pretty much the normal kind of kid that comes up in this thing. I was raised by two what I know now to be adult children of alcoholics. And I didn't know that then. Nobody did. My family was as dysfunctional as any family could be. And one reason why that's important to me is as I moved along and I kind of realized, my God, as I got sober, which we have in this fellowship, you know, we look and we have all these character defects, like tons of them. And the more I look, I'm like, my God, I couldn't have invented this stuff all myself in 34 years of living. I mean, you know, this is like hundreds of years of dysfunctional behavior. And so it dawned on me that I'd inherited a fair amount of it, which, of course, makes it's academic because it's up to me to work it out here in the steps. But I did realize, my God, I mean, I didn't learn this from drinking. I learned this one at home. I mean, So what I know now is they were both adult children of alcoholics. I didn't know it as a kid. I didn't know any of this stuff. I was just a kid that was abiding by the rules of my family. I thought that I would just carry on. Things would work out as they kind of would. My mom had that thing that happens to folks who grew up in alcoholic homes. And she loved me as much as she could. But maybe we alcoholics are more demanding of love. And maybe people who grew up in alcoholic homes just simply don't have it to give. And a lot of bad things, I believe, happened to her. As I grew up, in my relationship with my mom, we were close for a while, but something happened around the time I hit 15, and the things that started happening in her life were all those kind of those untreated Al-Anon issues. We just had a real rift. In fact, I ended up getting so mad at her, I actually plotted kind of killing her, because she would just do strange things, and it was just in my mind. Well, she wouldn't do strange. Well, she would do strange things. She embarrassed me all the time. And I was, keep in mind, by 15, I was kind of losing my own mind, so it was kind of a strange thing. How that came about was I had never known a feeling beyond fear growing up. And in fact, I never knew a feeling really beyond that except self-pity before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived with that feeling my entire life, and I didn't know what that was because I'd never been without it, ever. I just simply didn't know it. It was just that, you know, that uneasy feeling that we all know that's in our stomach. I lived with that feeling 24/7 the minute I woke up and then I went to bed. I didn't know any other way. You know, and the way I faced the world was just kind of in a defensive posture, that everything was potentially threatening to me in the world. And that's how I grew up, how I perceived it. My father, his notion was just kind of be bigger and stronger and all that kind of a thing. And I didn't turn out to be a giant, but and he was a little let down by that. But his notion was that if I were just tougher, everything would work out. And it just that's really what you got to do. You really got to be able to kind of kick butt to make it in this world. And so many, and then really that was the rules I grew up with. And I kind of believed that, but I didn't entirely buy it. You know, in a lot of ways, I feel like when I grew up, I wasn't insane. I had a lot of insane behaviors because none of us are insane, but we do insane things. I kind of had some cognition that this thing that they were telling me wasn't right. I mean, I could figure out things like, so you want to win at everything, right? You know, that's kind of what he was showing me to do. And only the winner is the one that's admired. Everybody else is a loser. And you've got to be the toughest and never lose in any confrontation, particularly a fight. And, I just simply did the math as soon as I was able to, and I realized, well, that's going to be an awfully tall order. There's only going to be one winner in the world. All the rest are going to be losers. How on earth am I going to get in that category? So I was a little suspicious of that game plan from the get-go. But we kind of stuck to it. It was, you know, we kind of went along with it, and he claimed that it was working in his life. And although there were certain things that happened along the way that kind of indicated that might have been entirely the case. But he kind of lived by it and claimed it was working, and I think maybe people kind of tolerated that. He worked in a paper, was a blue-collar guy, and you know, that could work for a while in there, but eventually he got into management, and oddly enough, later, he changed. Because, you know, he changed when he had to realize those attitudes really weren't going to be functional in management. So, but that was the kind of thing that I was learning. When I was little, he put me through karate lessons and all this stuff, you know, and that was a real hoot. I don't know if anybody ever got into karate. The only, nowadays, is, you know, all these mixed martial arts on TV and all that kind of stuff, it's more accepted. When I was a kid and you were in karate, it was because you were a wimp. I mean, that was it, man. You're taking karate, that's like, you know, I mean, that's the only kids that were in there. You'd go to the dojo and you'd have to cover your shoes as wood. The only kids that were in there are the ones that, their parents are sitting on the side, you know, looking at them, like, waiting for them to come out tough. I mean, I didn't buy that either, but I went along with it, and I said, God, when was this ever ended? So I can still remember, it was a couple days of the week I had karate lessons, and if I were to think hard enough, I could remember the day, because I felt abnormally sick those days, but I always had that queasy feeling. So, off we went to the karate place, and I'm going through the actions. I had no desire to learn it, to beat anybody up, to defend myself. I couldn't care less about any of it. But I'm going through the actions, and let me tell you, that was a strange place. The guy who ran the thing had a red and white belt, and in that particular type of karate, that's like black belts get like phases of black, and they turn red and white, and then they're red when you're at the very top. And he was the highest ranking Caucasian black belt, so to speak, in the country at the time. He had three sons, and they were pretty tough. And one day I'm in there, and the only thing I really remember is I'm sparring with this little kid, and he's really small, and I'm not doing anything, mind you. And all of a sudden he just starts crying, and you know, and this is bad. I look up, and here's all three sons going, you know, what did you do? I'm like, dude, I didn't do a thing to him. He just started crying. The next thing I know, I'm sparring with them. And we're going through this ritual, you know, they're going to set things straight. I'm like, oh, Jesus, man. I mean, that's what it was like with the karate lesson. So I, you know, luckily enough, got out of there. And somehow or another, I didn't have to take those too much longer. But that was the kind of mentality. I mean, it was a strange deck of cards, and I didn't quite understand it. I don't think it had 52 cards in it. And but I played them the best I could, and they apparently kind of flip them up, I would at times. So off I went. I think the first real freedom I got from any of this kind of thing was mischief. And when I hit the fifth grade, I realized that it was kind of like we all have. You know, boy, mischief kind of sets my mind free. And that little adrenaline drive, that thing followed me way into sobriety. In fact, it ended with mischief that was largely illegal. But it began with just doing things on the playground, like getting those rubber balls and hiding, and then when the playground teacher's back is to you, you toss it up lava to where it would land on her head. By the time it hit her, you'd be hidden. And they thought that was very entertaining. You know, just stuff like that. One day I was in class, and my three shot paper clips of our van. And one day, Miss Sage was over there. God, she hated me. And my friend Jay Copeland was there, and I was here, and it was in one of the movies. I loved the movies. When they turned the lights off, boy, that's when all, you know, what broke loose. And I shot this paper clip, and it whistled by his head, and it hit Miss Sage right in the face. And man, was she livid. And she looked, and she identified Jay Copeland, because he was closer, right between us. And he didn't snitch. I don't know if he knows to this day that I shot that paper clip. And I'm an alcoholic. I didn't tell him. I said, Jay, I need to do the right thing. It scared the life out of me. And she grabbed him. He denied it. She slapped him. I mean, this thing, oh, yeah, I mean, this thing was sailing, man. I mean, this woman was in pain. And, you know, I don't know to this day that I don't think I ever came clean with Jay. In fact, I kind of know I didn't. But that's just what it was like for me in school. And I went through and did those kind of things and clowned around and got a little escape that way and threw rocks at girls. That was the only way I could interact with them. They were very interesting to me. I kind of felt if I could bring one down with a rock, that I could capture one. I guess that was it. I can just think of the fifth grade standing out there on the swings and I'm throwing rocks at them. I mean, I think any psychologist, you know, they could have just kind of put any one of us in a little container and just watch them. You could just, like, Jesus, what is this behavior? I mean, I look back on it and some of the strange ways I interacted with the world. One day I found this big railroad spike out on the playground, and I just started carrying it around. I loved it. I wasn't going to hit anybody with it or anything. I never took it from me. And I used to take little crayons, and like when people were gone, I'd smash them on their desk with the railroad spike, and the crayon would actually stick to the desk. And it was like entertainment. And we had a classroom dance. And I pretended I was asleep holding my railroad spike. I mean, just strange things. If you were a psychologist, you'd go, my God, this guy needs some help. He's a little off the beaten path. So, you know, things moved along until, as you could probably imagine, with that kind of deck of cards. And this time, you know, Mom was kind of hanging along for the ride. Her and Dad had the exact relationship you'd guess. They tolerated each other. They didn't tolerate each other. They were indifferent toward each other. I mean, I knew from the get-go they didn't like each other, and they didn't like each other. And it was simply just a facade. There was nothing there that would resemble a marriage. And they went along like that. And about that time, 7th or 8th grade, you know, the mischief level kind of got up. But I was also really, really involved in sports. And I started, I think we all do, we have a very, I don't want to use obsessive compulsive because that sounds like a psychiatric diagnosis, but we're very intense when we want it to be. You know, we just have a way of biting onto something and never letting go, and it can actually drive us completely nuts. And I did that with some sports. And one of the sports I did was wrestling. I wanted to pick an individual sport since, obviously, I would have no way to get along with the team, no way to facilitate relationships with the team. I didn't fit in with the team because I hadn't found alcohol yet. So my relationships with our humans were only, the kids I hung around with were by and large adult children. Well, they were still children of alcoholics, but they later on, when they grew up, became adult children of alcoholics. But I tended to hang around with kids who were kind of like me, I guess, looking in retrospect. So I picked wrestling, and you can see I have the physique for wrestling. And when you've got this kind of physique, you know, you scare people from the mat, they just run out the door. There's only one other physique in here, Billy, that is less equipped for wrestling than mine. I mean, the other wrestlers are short, stocky, you know, they got big muscles, and you're like, I'm ready, dudes, you know. But, you know, my plan was like us. I would just work twice as hard and win. Isn't that all there is to it? If you just work twice as hard, you can win because you have that dogged determination. So I did that. And I got up in the morning. I'd exercise in the morning. I'd go to wrestling practice and exercise in the evening. And for a while, I kind of like for the first match or two, I did all right, or three or four or five. Early on, I was actually pretty good because most people weren't training that hard. But the alcoholic, I had a way of, I didn't do well under stress. We don't. Alcoholics just don't. I sure didn't. If anybody else, I mean, I just crumbled under stress. I just couldn't take it. Being an underdog was very easy, but when you're no longer an underdog, I couldn't perform. And that happened in my wrestling career. I just started losing and losing and losing. That would happen to me many times in my life. I couldn't quite understand. The harder I wanted to do something, the harder it became to me. In fact, it got so bad at one point where I was on a softball team, and you're not supposed to strike out in the way we played softball. It's really a game that you hit the ball, and people run around. It's meant to be played in the field. It's not a strikeout game with a pitcher, per se. You have a pitcher, but he's not designed to strike you out. Bounce the ball really high. If you have any eye-hand coordination whatsoever, you can hit the ball. It's like slow pitch, is basically what it was. I had gotten this thing in my head, I couldn't hit the ball anymore. And I would strike out in softball. It was the weirdest thing. I couldn't understand it. My dad couldn't understand it. Nobody could understand it. But it was that strange, for me, it was that strange obsessive desire to just, I don't know, I just had to succeed. And it just tore me up. That boomerang that Bill Wilson talks about in the book, that he flung, it would come back and cut him up, that desire to win, basically just would sabotage everything I ever did. And it would cause me to work harder and harder. Once that would start happening, my solution was to work harder, work harder. In wrestling, being a smart guy, I figured out, like we all are, I mean, alcoholics, we're all very smart, I mean, there's no question about that. I figured out what a calorie was and figured I could lose weight. So in the locker room, when we would weigh in, I would find I'd see my guy over there, he looked pretty formidable, but the guy in a weight class down didn't look so formidable. This is a great example, I think, of alcoholic thinking. He didn't look so formal, and I think, if only I were wrestling that guy, because we kind of pair up, we get on the scale, he'd get on, you get on, they put the little balance, the next weight class, you get on. And you're standing there in your underwear. I mean, nowadays this stuff would probably be all illegal, a whole bunch of boys standing in their underwear. but that's the way it was then, and we were fine. And I think if I could just get down a weight class to that guy's weight class, I'd have this thing beat. Well, here's the alcoholic thingy part, it never dawned on me. When I get there, he'll be the same size as me. but I didn't get that far. So I lost the weight, and I got down like, dog, I made it. Man, I'm down in this class now. And I'm like, dog, what? I swear to God, that guy didn't look so big last time. But the dude under him sure looks much more. So I got down to that weight. I was eating string beans. That's all I lived on, canned beans. You can lose a lot of weight exercising in canned beans. Well, I got to where basically I looked anorexic. I mean, I couldn't wrestle anymore just by the laws of leverage. You know, if your femur is this long, you've got this much muscle attaching one end to the other. Not a lot of movement came out of that. It's like wrestling a skeleton, They're going to throw me all on the mat. But if I could just sit down the next weight class, it just kept feeding into itself. It got so bad at the end of the year, the coach was like, Jesus, I mean, whatever happened to you, I don't know what it is. They didn't know. I mean, it even got stranger than that. When the season ended, I couldn't eat. I could not eat again. Some bizarre obsession had kind of taken. I thought, it's like I'd gone all this way. I ain't turning back now. I'm ready for next year. I'm going to train until next year. So I jumped in on track. And it is possible to get lapped in track. I can tell you that. I can remember the coach. That was my sport is. The coach saying the objective today is just stay up with the pack. You can just stay up with the pack. Trust me, mind you, I weigh 89 pounds at this point. I'm like 5'10". No one even knows. This is a small, small town, Washington State. Nobody is putting anything together. Not that there's anything to put together. Anyway, so my objective was to stay up, and I just couldn't. I mean, I'd hang in there a lap, but it just wouldn't work. The string beans just weren't enough. At one point he said, you know what, if you don't gain some weight, I'm not going to let you back in the weight room, because that was part of the training, the track was going to the gym. But he was a guy, he's amazing, we all know this, it's amazing how you can manipulate people, and I was able to just kind of show up a week later and kind of keep hanging around. Who would keep a well-intentioned kid like me out of the gym, right? So I'm back in the gym. And it's just how it went. Well, that was kind of the end of my sports career, so to speak. It was pivotal, and it was, had a lot of, not too many trophies to show for that endeavor. But somewhere along the line, right around in there, I discovered something that would that brought me this fellowship and removed all that stuff. And it was alcohol. And it didn't hit the very first time for me. I had to do it a few times, but I worked diligently at it because I was around friends whose parents were alcoholic. And they had large stashes of alcohol. And we kept working at it until one day it kind of happened. And the kid that I was with kept telling me it would happen. He's an alcoholic, no question about it. I mean, I knew that then. But But he kept saying, just keep drinking, Mark. It's coming. It'll come. I'm like, what is it, John? It'll come. And whatever other things we could, mind you, we were not particular. We could put anything we could put our hands on. I can tell you right now, there has never been a day ever in my life that I have not taken anything that anybody said would relieve the way I thought. So just put that right in my story. I mean, it's just, I didn't know. I said, you know, just say no, I don't do that. This is an AA meeting. There was one time when I had to go mop the floor. Oh, Jesus. But that wasn't entirely true either. We had this job that we used to go set up the Elks Club for meetings. And we would get so inebriated before we'd go in there that one day myself and John went in there and we sit, and this was a huge hall, and it takes like 2 hours to set up the chairs, and we are just, you know, just totally out of our minds, and we set the thing up, this is perfect, it's all set up, and the guys show up and they say, that's great, but today's Tuesday, that's Wednesday's setup. Tuesday doesn't have the chairs, it has the tables, and we had to take the entire thing entirely down. That's the kind of stuff that we did. We thought it was great, except it was the wrong day. But that's all right. We liked the Elks Club. We had a bar, and when we were the janitors, we spent our time in the bar. You can guess that we didn't do too much setting up in that place. So I discovered alcohol. It began to work. And let me tell you, if you start drinking and taking other substances that increase your appetite, you can go from being 89 pounds to 150 pounds in about 2 months. And if you do that, you won't gain a lot of lean mass right away, but you will gain breasts. And I don't recommend that for women who are wanting to augment themselves to do that. But I remember laying on the couch at this point in my life watching TV and thinking to myself, how on earth have I developed breasts? I mean, I couldn't quite figure it out. I mean, it never dawned on me. It was very much akin to my lifestyle. I mean, so you can do it, and it was one extreme to the other. I got a new wardrobe out of it. Well, I guess the alcohol really kind of started to set in. I drank every opportunity I could, and I didn't know what a blackout was, but I knew that when I would stop, when the next morning when drinking was over, I would always be at home without my car. And I had to call people to find out where my car is, because my dad would always go out and say, where's the car? And my Jesus, Dad, I wish I could tell you. And yeah, it was a little, they were a little bothered by that, not too entirely taken back. And I know now that my dad saw horrendous examples of alcoholism as I grew up. And I know now the reason he didn't react to that is that he grew up in the same environment. This wasn't abnormal, particularly abnormal behavior to him. To me it would be. I mean, today, knowing what I know now, if my kid goes out of the car back, where do you think it is? You don't remember? Well, that's a problem. Well, so I kind of drank like that. And I had a, God knows, I would just drink and I would just, alcohol's always affected me this way. Always. It's just made me absolutely wild. I would drink and I would do everything that I was afraid to do the first many years of my life. And it included everything. Like one day at the state fair, those great big state flags that they have flying over there. If you just look like you know what you're doing, you can go up there, untie it, take the flag down, pull it up, and steal it, and nobody will say anything. It's just stupid. Just push the envelope further and further, or go into a store. I couldn't go into a store without stealing something. Not even stuff I didn't even want. I mean, it was just impossible to walk into a store without stealing stuff. Even my dad. We'd go in there, not even my friends. Hey, Dad, how are you? He's going to Fred Meyer to get something. I'm like, hey, I'll be right back. And I'd go over there and steal something. I just, half the time, I didn't even need it. Well, I mean, that's just the effect alcohol had on me. It just made me absolutely wild. I drank every opportunity I could have drank, as much as I could, every single time I could drink. And it was all good. Life was good. I felt good. I was pretty much free of a lot of that fear. I felt good about myself. And at that age, I'm not doing too much damage. But strange things started happening to me as I went on. One is that feeling got a little harder to catch, and so it always propelled me to more and more, and more meant whatever more could be in any area. But I started doing some things that were outright criminal. Well, not that shoplifting is not criminal, or just going out in the middle of the night and stealing everything you put your hands on, or breaking and entering is not criminal. Those weren't really criminal. I mean, but really criminal is things that were dangerous to other people. And I hadn't really done any of those things yet. Well, my driving was always dangerous to other people. Yeah, you know, that, just think about that. Well, on that same trip going to that fair, I don't know which time it was, but my friend and I decided to put sunglasses on at night and drive. And of course, you know, we ended up spinning out in the middle of an intersection of a very busy road, and just, we didn't get a wreck, but just, yeah, I mean, the reason nobody died in because of the stuff I did was just, I don't know why they didn't die. I was the kind of guy, when I would drive sober, I would get into car racing, and I loved car racing, that if you had two lanes going this way, and there was a third lane, and a turn ahead of you, but the third lane was the oncoming lane, I would take it, and you could win that way. You could actually get around the competition out there. Those kind of silly things I would do on the way to school. That's a trip to school sober. That's how my brain got it. It was just that kind of a person. It's amazing when you take somebody who had so much fear and then remove the fear with adrenaline or alcohol, what you get. I mean, it's the strangest thing. You look at it, and it almost sounds courageous, but there was nothing. I know a little bit today about what courage is, and I had no idea what it was then. The things that I did that bothered me the most were things like the one that sets out the most of my mind. Is one day we went out. I used to work in this restaurant called the little tiny restaurant. We had a little fry joint. And I used to love to throw eggs. And they had these things in there that you could get 144 eggs, 12 dozen eggs that came in a great big box. And I would call my friend, and he'd meet me behind the restaurant at a particular hour, and I'd come running out with 144 eggs, and I'd hand them to him, he'd throw his car and drop. Well, after I got off later, we would go throw eggs. Everything you could find, anything you could find. Police officers, anything. We had more fun with that. In fact, while I was at work, I used to like to go behind the restaurant and lob eggs over the restaurant out on the Pacific Highway and hit cars. And they would stop and turn the light and they'd say, somebody threw an egg in my car from your restaurant. And of course, I'm like washing the dishes. By the time they get in there, I'm standing there like, what? Dude, you know. You lost your mind. I don't eat you. Stuff like that. I just love that restaurant. We used to get these huge Dairy Gold cans of whipped cream. And I don't know if there's any imaginative guys in this crowd, but there's a lot of stuff you can do with those. It doesn't take much to figure that out. So I got to where work was kind of long and bothersome. I just kind of go into the walk-in refrigerator and grab one of those Dairy Gold cans and inhale the propellant out of it, which is nitrous oxide, put it back on the shelf, and then walk in. It just kind of eased the day a little bit. You can do that at grocery stores, too. I bet you know that. You go straight to the grocery. You know, when we go to the store, we go straight to the whipped cream, then we go to the eggs, and maybe the spray paint. As alcoholics, we have an interesting, kind of shopping cart, so to speak, of what's important to the grocery store. So one day, though, these cans, after you do that, the whipped cream won't come out of them anymore. It just runs out. And they're having this happen a lot in the restaurant. And the management decides to call Dairy Gold to find out what's going on. Well, oddly enough, Dairy Gold has run into this problem one time before. And they said, you're selling us defective cans. And they said, no, we're not. There's somebody in your organization that's inhaling the propellant. But no worries. I mean, you know how we are. No denial. We look pretty good. We're pretty sensible people. So they call us all out, and the lady said, well, and we're here all standing there, me and four others, and she said, these cans, somebody's inhaling the propellant out of these cans, and I'm standing there, Jesus, man. I don't know which of you guys could be doing that. Well, it looked pretty bad, because this was this Mexican, every other person that worked there was an old Japanese woman. They used to call me Marky Sun. In Japanese, that's a term of affection, Marky Sun. And I mean, it was like that. So it didn't take much care who was, who had the whipped cream can. That job didn't last. So off from there I went, and I went on to so many other jobs. And I once had a job where I buried cable TV cables, and I would go to the wrong house, and all kinds of stuff. They'd come in the morning, they had a gas station. I was supposed to man the gas station, because I wasn't doing too good on the cables. They said, we just manned the gas station. The boss would pull up. I am so hungover, sound asleep with my head on the desk. They could have filled their cars. I mean, like hundreds of people could have come in there and filled their cars and left. I would have known the difference. They walk in there, and I'm just Sunday morning. So that job didn't last. Of course, we stole the gas we could from there too. Me and my friend, gas in our cars pretty regularly. Well, I had to be moving along in this story, but so that's what it was like. It was a lot of fun. But one day we ran out of eggs, throwing at cars that night, and we decided to throw rocks at cars instead, and big rocks at that. And I didn't realize what was happening to me, but it just made kind of sense at the time. And we were passing cars head on. We'd heave out a rock about the size of a softball or cantaloupe or whatever we happened to have. And those were the sorts of things that I kind of started doing. And I couldn't quite understand why that was. The night that happened, we got caught by somebody. They got our license number. We got away physically, but they got our license number. And I got a call the next morning. This guy said, you know, I know you did this, and I'm really, really mad. I don't know why I don't turn you to the police, but I'm going to let you pay for this. And so when you're making, you know, $1.75 an hour at the wagon wheel, it takes a long time to pay off a window. So I met with him regularly, and he said, if you pay me regularly, I'm not going to call the police. And I paid him regularly. And when I first met him, he just thought I was some sort of a delinquent, and he just treated me as such. And as time went on, he got to know me, and he realized I'm not a delinquent, I'm an alcoholic, but he didn't understand that. And I can still remember, as we parted ways, that we were kind of good friends, and in his mind, there was this huge thing that made no sense to him. How could this guy have done that? He just couldn't understand. Well, he didn't understand it was alcoholism. How you can take normal people and have them commit heinous crimes. I mean, somebody could have gotten killed for that. The second thing that I did... it kind of raised a red flag with me, not that these others shouldn't have, was got in a high-speed police pursuit. And this is before the days of, we didn't have the helicopter at that time. And this was in Washington State, and one night I graduated from junior college, and I don't know how. I don't want to get into that, but you can actually graduate from junior college and not be sober too much. And I was celebrating graduation. We were driving down the road. I had a 1969 Corvette because when I was little, I got bit by a dog. That's how I got these scars. And we sued the people whose dog bit me, put the money in the bank, and then appreciated to enough money to buy a 19—what do you think would be an intelligent thing to do if you had some money and you're 18? Of course, buy a 1969 Corvette. I mean, college or something like that would be ridiculous thought. So when they said you're 18, you can take the money. We can't stop you. I'm like, oh, really? So I was driving down the highway, and the police were on the other side of that little rail that keeps you from, that once you get off, like you're going to get off the highway, pretty soon a median comes, and you can't get back on the highway. So we pulled up beside them and gave them the fingers, showed them our whiskey bottles, laughed at them, and took off. And let me tell you what, those cruisers are special because they can actually get from one side of the median to the other. I don't know how he did it, but the next thing I know, I looked in the mirror, he was back there. So, but no problem. I did the right thing at that point. I dropped a hammer. And off the floor. I got that thing up to 135 on I-5 in Seattle and Tacoma. And we were going so fast that we couldn't get off on the The exits were just going by us too fast, and my friend kept saying, get off the highway. And I'm like, I can't, man, we're going too fast. So finally I get slowed down and get off the highway. And by now they're just coming from everywhere, this whole string of police behind us. And you'd kind of get ahead of one and some more would come, and it was just really, it was turning into a nightmare. And like any normal person, this was a nightmare a long time ago, but for me it was just becoming one. And what I did was I started going through red lights without stopping on busy streets. And it looked just like the guys on TV, all those alcoholics we see on TV get chased all over. That's exactly what it looked like. But I got away. But we didn't get away entirely, but we got away enough. That means that I made a couple turns. We parked the car in this guy's backyard, kind of his flower garden. Jumped out, tore off our clothes. Ran in the house and pretend we were asleep, and the police knew that the car disappeared right in that neighborhood, in that little area, so they took them 2 minutes to find it. They knocked on the door, and we came out and pretend we were asleep. You know, he woke us up, and he said, is this your car? I said, yes, sir, officer. He said, well, we believe you were not in a pursuit tonight. I said, no, we've been here for a couple hours now. If you can imagine what a 1969 Corvette would look like when it's just been run wide open for a long time and then turned off and jumped out of, like the steam's coming out of it, the motor's making that like tick, tick, tick sound. I mean, but, you know, and we're all standing there like, it's been here for 2 hours. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of it. But I was out of the car and they couldn't do anything to us. And that was kind of the story of my drinking. It went on like that, and I continued to drink like that every opportunity I could. And those things start happening to me. There were criminal things, things I wasn't, that I was now ashamed of. They weren't funny things anymore. They were things that were injurious to other people, potentially so. And as my drinking progressed, there was never a time ever that somebody else's welfare ever came between me and a drink, ever. And I just did what I had to get what I needed. And that was kind of the story of my life. Oddly enough, I could have periods of abstinence. And I was able to get through college with a period of abstinence. I graduated with a 4-year degree. Now, my dad had a plan for me, and it was to go to medical school. He said, if you want to make it in this world, you need to go and be a lawyer or a doctor. So, I mean, not that I had any idea what either of them meant, but I understood. He said, if you do this, you'll have some money and some freedom and some power. Now, if you tell an alcoholic that, of course, it's no different than telling somebody in the ghetto, if you buy cocaine and sell it, you're going to have some money, some freedom, and some power. I had no desire, no altruistic notion whatsoever. I had no concept of helping anybody else beyond how it would make me look. And I thought that seemed like a very reasonable plan to my alcoholic mind. And my intentions were simply no different than that because they couldn't have been. They could have been. I'm an alcoholic. That's how I think. I didn't have periods of moral thinking followed by debacles with alcohol. I'm the guy that if you took the alcohol away, the problem was right there. The problem wasn't the alcohol. I mean, I got vomit on my shoes and stuff from the alcohol, but the character defects, that they were all right there. And they were firmly seated with that bizarre competitive attitude that is just win, win, win at any cost. The most important thing in this world is money. Find as much of it as you can. And in fact, when I was 18, this is kind of a sad truth, my friend, who was an alcoholic, naturally, said to me, he said, there's three things in life. His name was Carl Hammers. I mean, Carl was a real winner. From time to time I had smoked marijuana. He was the one that showed me that you could actually take a World War II face mask and rig it up to smoke marijuana out of it. So you know that Carl, Carl's hitting on all 8 cylinders, you know what I mean? Carl was such a bad drunk that he never noticed his car was falling apart. He had a 66 Barracuda. And we're always drunk, so he'd run into things, and one day he runs into this tree, and it makes a little divot in the front. What does Carl do? The hood latches on. He just puts a big chain around it and keeps driving. I mean, me and I'm like, Carl, he's got mag wheels and a chain holding the hood down. I mean, it's like, this is not cool. But so Carl was going out quick. But he was a philosopher, and he told me, he said, Mark, here's three things. You want success in life, comes this way. Fast car, a loud stereo, and some women. If you can do those three things, man, you've got it. And when I was 32 years old and I got sober, I looked at my life, and the things that I had tried to attain the most were exactly those three things. My objective hadn't changed whatsoever. That's the natural, the alcoholic objective. So I did that. I went through medical school, got into a medical school. God forbid, people in medicine aren't very smart always when it comes to alcoholism. And they accepted me and they educated me. Some of them kind of got on that there was something wrong with me from a moral standpoint. I wasn't drinking in medical school. I could do the time. I could always do the time. We have dogged determination. At this point, my alcohol, I didn't have to drink every minute. So I made it through, but they noticed there was a problem with me, and that was I just didn't tell the truth, because the truth was never an important thing to me. So that crops up in strange places in medical school. Like they'd say, all right, I want you to go see this patient and then come back and tell me what they said and what's wrong with them. So I go see him, and I'm not, there's no retention, I'm not focused, I'm like, yes, and I come back, and they ask me questions, and I make up answers. Because, you're supposed to have asked that question, like, well, did she say she had a headache? She had to probably have a headache with this condition. Yeah, she had a headache. Okay. Where about? I can hear. and this went on for a while, and not every rotation is it like that. Like if you're on a surgery rotation, the surgeons are cutting stuff out. Your alcoholic brain is manifest. This is in family medicine where you have to talk to patients and understand them. So if you're a liar, we come out. So anyway, they said, there's something wrong with me. They turned me into the dean. I'm sitting there one day, and I remember telling Dr. Price, he's a great old guy from Western Kansas. And he said, I said, Dr. Price, I said, I believe those women got something out for me.
really said, I can see that the gears turning. I pulled it off.
He said, yeah, I think I do too. All right, you can go. There's nothing wrong with you. So off I went. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't even know I was lying. I thought everybody kind of fudges me, right? Nobody really knows the answers to these questions. Come on. Look at the draw. So, graduated from there and decided to go become an anesthesiologist. And this seemed like a logical thing for me to do. I mean, I was interested in pharmacy, and I already found the PDR, and so off I went. And I really, really didn't have the problems you think I was going to have. I really didn't have that for the first year of the residency. And everything was going well. I mean, I liked it. It was, you know, there was you could have some money. There was minimal patient contact. You really didn't have to have, and I was very technical. And mind you, I've been building engines, race engines. I had very good technical skills. We alcoholics are smart and very, very capable. There'll never be a day ever that an alcoholic can't do something because of lack of intelligence or capability. It'll be fear or some other reason why we don't do it. So, I made my way through that. People said, do you want some money? Do this. I said, okay. And that was pretty much my motivation. I never drew too many sober breaths. I got drunk 3 out of 4 nights. It's so bad that I had to move to the end of Chicago where in the residency where the bars were because I didn't want to drive and lose my car. And that kind of thing. So I had to move to the bars, found a nice little watering hole, and in that watering hole was one of those kind of bars. It's a real seedy place. I didn't like drinking on the weekends. Because there were a lot of non-alcoholics out there clogging up stuff, and it really makes a mess out of things. If you're trying to drink and you're around non-alcoholics, and you're an alcoholic and you're acting like an alcoholic, they don't want to have fun with you. They've been like annoyed with me at times. But on weekdays, if you're in a bar at 10:30 p.m. in Chicago, you're there with only alcoholics because all the normal people have to go and get up the next morning and go to work. And so I loved it. I mean, I made sure every single night by 10:30 I was in the bar with my beer in my hand. And and I just lived in that place. It was a fun little bar. I met all kinds of interesting people, all alcoholics. Well, I did that 3 or 4 nights, and the fourth night, I had to be on call every fourth night, so I'd find other ways to keep my mind quiet in the hospital with some of the stuff that I was supposed to be giving to patients. So there wasn't any time that I was sober ever during that much of that residency. But I made it through. I had problems with forgetting things a lot. A lot of amnesia was setting in, like I'd forget all kinds of stuff, as you could kind of guess. I mean, like I'd come to work the next day and couldn't remember the patients and stuff like that. And people were a little alarmed by that, but it was the same thing like that family practice thing. I could just say, well, I don't know. I mean, nothing really comes of it. Nobody understood or could recognize it. Why somebody would have to be completely amnestic the next morning. Like, I remember once, I really forgot all the patients' names on the service when I was an intern. And we'd go around and visit them, see them in their rooms. And I would always go in and introduce myself. And, hi, Mrs. Jones, it's good to meet you. And the residents, everybody's looking at me like, I'm nuts. Because she's been there for like 3 weeks. And that would go on day after day after day. And finally somebody says, Mark, is something bothering you? I'm like, no, Carol, why would you ask that? She says, because you forget every patient every day in the service. I'm like, oh, really? I didn't know I was doing it. I'm like, oh, really? I mean, since I forget them, I didn't know I'd forgotten them. I'm like, which one? like, they're all not brand new, Mark. Some of them have been here a long time. Oh, yeah? Which one? And I didn't say that. I'm like, oh, okay, Carol. But I knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. Carol was just a resident. She didn't have power. So there was the end of that. After I got a clipboard. And I put down their names and everything about them so that, so I wouldn't get lost. I walked in and been in the hospital for 3 weeks now. She has this and that and this and that. So, made it through there and made it through the residency. Graduated. In the middle of that, got married and divorced. Usual kind of stuff to do. And graduated. And, man, I was ready for the world. God, I had this thing, I had a degree, and I was going to go make some money. So I did the right thing. Being that I couldn't work around people, I had to find a place where there was one anesthesiologist. So I found a real small town in North Carolina, and I went to work there. And from the time, let me tell you, small town, North Carolina, population 10,000, it's a dry town. You can only buy wine and beer, which, what do you do with that? And And there was one bar in town, and people shag danced in it. I don't know if, I didn't know what that meant.
But I like to be in Chicago where no one knows you, where you could just be a complete idiot and drink till you couldn't see, and it really wasn't that abnormal to me. No one really seemed to care. Except the next morning, you had to call all the bars, because I was a big shot, and find your credit cards. Because somewhere along the line, I went like this, run me a tab, Joe, and gave my credit card, and then the next morning, you wake up, you have none of your credit cards, and you can't figure out where you left them, so you call the places. Other than that, it was great. Well, they didn't drink like that in this small town, so I had to find other ways to quiet my mind. And I did. Being an anesthesiologist, I found that there were many substances that I could use to keep myself quiet, keep my mind quiet. That worked very well for a while. And but let me tell you, if you don't think that one alcoholic in a hospital keeping his quiet, his mind quiet, can't consume a shitload of substances, you're wrong. You really can. It got such, I mean, it was like the hospital consumption of narcotics doubled, and I guess the DEA or the FBI or these people know about these red flags. So the next thing I know, everybody's looking at us kind of funny, and they're asking questions, and I'm like, Jesus, what's the big deal? I've got needle holes all over me. I mean, it's just completely out of control, and I know they're coming, so I know I can't quit, man. There's no way I can quit. My thoughts at this point were completely out of control. So I did. I knew they were coming. So I called my girlfriend at the time, who was also pregnant, and I said, "They're coming." And I knew how they would test me. They would want some urine and that kind of thing. And so I said, "Well, bring me some urine and an apple. Put in a bag so it looks like lunch." And she did the right thing. She brought me some urine and an apple. She was very sick too. So I took that urine, I stuck it in a little IV bag, put it in my arm, and I ran a little tube, IV tube, down in my shorts. They knew they were coming, so I was going to, give them that urine. I was ready, and I was walking around practicing that thing, ready to drop a hat to give the urine. I knew they were coming. I could read it on the people's faces in that hospital. And sure enough, they came, and off we went. We went through the song and dance, and they interrogated me, and I lied, like everything. It was a regular intervention, that kind of thing. And then, the proverbial urine came, and I said, all right, fair enough, urine it is. So off we go, and they're going to witness my urination. But I practiced that little roller valve, and I could get to work and everything. So I gave him the urine, but lo and behold, I only had about that much in the cup. And it's a laboratory, for God's sakes. How much urine do you need? Well, apparently, it has to go above the temperature strip. You know what I mean? So they told me that. They said, this is not, you need more. I'm like, I was out. It ran out. More. All right, So I disappeared. I said, well, let me go get a Coke. So I ran back to the hospital, and I actually found her urine. It was still sitting there. By now, it's all cloudy, and it looks terrible. It's been sitting there 3 days. And I put it back in a little bag and came running back in, and I said, I'm ready. And they said, okay. And I gave it to them, and it was so cloudy, you couldn't even see through it. I mean, and the temperature at that point of the urine was 73 degrees. I can still remember it was room temperature, it was 72. I didn't have it in my arm long enough. What is this in this cup? I'm like, well, you saw where it came from. What do you think it is? They never pieced that together. About 3 days later, I had my last drink before then. I had what turned out to be the last mood-altering substance of any sort I'd ever have. I went to work like any other day. By then, I was consuming quantities of mind-altering substances, anesthetics that were enough to do operations like have your gallbladder removed. And I would take those on a daily basis, and they would do nothing to me. I could find no relief anywhere for the way I felt. Nothing would touch it anymore. It was a fire that burned out of control and just consumed me. So I did the only thing I knew how to do, was I called them, the medical board, and I said, come and get me. I need some help. And they did. They came and packed me off, and I went to treatment. And they said, well, I want to tell you about your urine, good news and bad news. And I didn't want to go to jail. And I think, I don't know, they diverting narcotics is a federal offense. I guess that's not, it's not something that you want to do. But somehow or another, they just quit investigating me when I went to treatment. I think they just did that to be out of kindness. Well, the good news was that my urine was clean. The bad news was I was pregnant.
I found it out while I was in treatment, so I mean, more good news. It's always nice when you're in treatment and you're married to somebody else and your girlfriend's pregnant and you've got no job, medical license, hope to ever have one, and the medical board is really pissed at you. And that's where I started, and no hope of ever staying sober. I had no desire. I couldn't conceive a life sober. When I was in treatment, I talked guys into going out. I'd never smoked crack. I said, let's go smoke some crack. It seems like a real reasonable thing to do. My whole life's over. So off we rode into the part of town where you could buy crack. And somebody had a moment of clarity. One of the guys that was with us, one of the four of us that went. And he said, we're not doing it. Get back in the car. And he weighed about 300 pounds. And he was a tough guy. And I had only seen tough guys. I wasn't one. So back in the car I went. And off we went. And I was very angry. And we rode back to the treatment center. And... But by the grace of God, I mean, there's an example of God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I don't know what would have happened to me that night. I don't know what my story would have been. I really don't know if I did. So I stayed in the treatment center. I had a great time in treatment. If anybody's been in treatment, I had a lot of real problems when I was in treatment. Like, man, my life is falling apart, and they're wanting me to do art therapy. I mean, it is stuff like that. We're having family times. I'm like, dude, I'm starving. You know? The art therapy was the one that got me the worst. And, draw something. And if you didn't draw something that has some psychological value to these people, they'd really jump on you. Like, come on, man, you're holding back. So I'm trying to make up stuff. Like, this will certainly seem in Freudian mind. This will be important. I'll draw this. You know, it was like that. And they're like, you're faking. I'm like, no, I'm not. I mean, it was compliance. Of course it was compliance. They had my medical license. There was no recovery. You can't mandate recovery. Harry Tebow told us that in 1953. And we just, in fact, printed the article to give to some other people. It was called Compliance, the Enemy of Recovery. And Harry Tebow was the first psychiatrist that referred people to Alcoholics Anonymous and went on to become a trustee in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the article was explained to other doctors who refer to Alcoholics Anonymous that compliance is not what we're looking for. We're looking for recovery. If you accept compliance or create situations where people comply, it'll actually be detrimental to their recovery. So, oddly enough, I learned that myself, too. I didn't like authority, and they told me things I had to do. They told me I had to go to this weird thing. It's like AA. It's called Caduceus. It's, I don't know what it is. And to this day, I went to one of those meetings. I got out of there. I said, Jesus, I need to go to an AA meeting. This is crazy, man. This is going to drive me nuts in here. Never went back. I mean, the guy that ran the physician's health program is four chairs down. I'm 30 days sober, or 6 months sober, whatever it was. And they're like, anybody got a problem? I'm like, not me, man. Life's good, you know. You know, what am I going to do? And of course, I'm alive. So they told me to go to AA, kind of. And so I did, and they said, we want a meeting list of all your meetings. And I intentionally falsified that thing. I went to way more meetings, way different meetings than the ones I put on there. And the reason I did that is I would not comply. I was not going to comply. They had everything. They had my future. They had everything. But I wasn't going to give them my AA. That was 1 hour of the night that I connected with my people, and my people were not their people. And that was going to be crystal clear. And that very thing saved my life. That was the compliance. It wasn't compliance. It was recovery. And I stuck to that and stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And remarkable things came to pass. Every problem I've ever had has been completely removed from me. Every health problem, every problem. I was able to pay every debt I had. The career I was thrown out of, they told me, don't ever come back. We don't want you to come back. I went and trained in another entire specialty and learned it and began to practice it, and that was emergency medicine. And then one day, I was in a place, this was long after the medical board turned me loose, and they were done with me, because every time they'd see me, they'd go, what have you been up to? And I'd say, well, that's interesting you'd ask. I'd just tell them about AA. I would just start from the beginning. Well, here's what I do. I work these steps, I sponsor these people, we do these projects, we carry them to prison. Pretty soon they got tired of hearing it. They said, don't come back. So I stopped coming. And I was free. And one day, I was at a party, and page 100 of the big book says, if our spiritual mind is right, we can go anywhere and do anything. And that sobriety plans based on being away from things won't work. And I had an opportunity to go back to do anesthesiology. And there was a gal, they were looking for some people to cover the weekends at their hospital. And I said, I don't do that anymore. I don't practice anesthesia. And she said, come give it a try. I said, I'm not going to do it. Come give it a try. Well, my wife encouraged me. People encouraged me. And so I went back. And oddly enough, like my sponsor always says, you get up where you fell down. That I went back to anesthesia and found that I just absolutely love it. And I got up where I fell down. And this time I went back to give to the profession rather than take. And I amended myself. And in the process of amending myself, in my profession, it's a lifelong process. I took from everything I could and now I give to everything I can. I stayed in that small group for a while and had the opportunity to train. Somebody offered to retrain me because the guy that they had scheduled to retrain got divorced at the last minute, and there was no time for them to find somebody else. I had kind of a sordid past, but I was the only applicant left because it was so late when this guy backed out. They called me up, and I'm like, they said, when can you be there? I said, well, it's about 3.5 hours from here. How was 4 hours? And off I went. When I was done with that year, I didn't know what I would do after that. They said, we'd like to hire you. I thought they were talking to somebody else at a major academic institution here on the East Coast. And I said, I'll stay. Of course I'll stay. And the culmination of that is since then, there's not been a year that's gone by. I've gotten awards for teaching. Because I became so interested in giving and because of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done to us, the university decided they were going to take people and make a pilot program. They were going to teach doctors how to teach. And the way they were going to do that was they were going to give them the opportunity to have a master's in education, and they'd pay for it and take us out of the clinic, out of the OR in my case, and let us go to this thing. And they would pay for it. And myself and 8 other physicians from various other professions, other specialties, had the opportunity to do this. And that's where I am today. And tomorrow I'll be in class from 1 till 7 p.m. And I'll have read my homework by then. And that's what life's been like, Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have a chance to talk about my program, but what I do is I do it the triangle. We work the 12 steps. We have a 12-step workshop. We bring people through the 12 steps until they've recovered. We go into service. We carry the message to the very best of our ability. Our primary purpose is to become a maximum is to increase our ability to carry the message, still serving alcoholics. We do that in corrections, with professionals, with the general public, and the fourth arm of AA services and treatment centers. And we're active in our group in all 4 of those areas. And we do it with unity. We have a group, and we meet, and we do things together. We don't take service commitments alone, because we do it together. That way there's unity. And you don't get, you know, the Mark Nelson version. You get the consensus of the committee and the home group. Thanks for having me.